You're listening to a recording from the Open Society Institute, working to build vibrant and tolerant democracies worldwide. Visit us at soros.org.
Good afternoon. Good afternoon, everyone. My name is Joe Onik, and I'm delighted to welcome you on behalf of the Open Society Institute to this special event in honor of the 10th anniversary of the U.S. programs of OSI. After the panel at the reception, Gara LaMarche, the director of Open Society Programs, and others will tell you a little about what OSI has been doing in the United States in the last decade and what plans are for the future. But for now, we're just going to focus on this panel. I am required, apparently, to make the following announcement. This event is being recorded by the Open Society Institute. Your presence constitutes your permanent and irrevocable grant of legal consent to OSI to record your name, voice, and appearance in connection with this event and thereafter, to reproduce, distribute, and publicly present the recording in any media, whether now or hereafter known. Why they love lawyers department. Well, we're sitting here in the Spy Museum, which to a considerable extent glorifies the technology of surveillance. In fact, of course, surveillance doesn't require high technology. Think about the Stasi in East Germany. But at the same time, technological developments have made it dramatically easier for governments and the private sector to collect information, store information, analyze information, and disseminate information about all of us. And those developments are continuing apace. The cost, for example, of sensors, whether used in cameras or radio frequency IDs, are essentially moving to nothing so that there'll be no financial barriers to their use. Over the weekend, there was a story that many of you may have read about gunshot sensors being used by the District of Columbia, but sensors are now incredibly cheap. There are also other developments that are going to make it easier and easier to analyze and make use of the massive information that is being collected. I'll just mention three. Researchers are working on face recognition technology, or GAIT, G-A-I-T, recognition technology. This technology, when it comes online, will enable people using video surveillance to track any individual whenever he or she is in public space, and it is likely to increase the demand for more video surveillance. In addition, computers are getting better and better at listening to our conversations and reading our email, and then reporting to actual human beings if concerning patterns arise. And of course, new technologies, data mining technologies, are being refined all the time to enable governments and others to sift through the masses of data that are now being collected. So how should our society respond to these developments? Scott McNeely of Sun Microsoft very famously said, "You have zero privacy, get over it." Or as we would say in New York, forget about it. But realistically, we can't forget about it because pervasive surveillance implicates so many of our most important rights, First Amendment rights, equal protection rights, the right, as Brandeis said, to be let alone. So we can't simply forget about it, and we have assembled here a panel of people who themselves do not and will not forget about it. I think many of the panel members, or all the panel members, are known to most of you. Full titles and bios are in your program. I'll just introduce them very briefly. Starting on my left, Jim Dempsey is Policy Director for Center for Democracy and Technology, also a member of the Markle Task Force on National Security in the Information Age. Jan Laurie Goldman is a professor at Columbia University, Director of the Health Privacy Project. Kate Martin is Director of the Center for National Security Studies and a longtime advocate on civil liberties issues. Arye Nair, to my immediate right, is president of OSI, formerly executive director of ACLU and Human Rights Watch. And Jeff Rosen is a professor at George Washington Law School, the author of two highly regarded books on privacy. Jim, I'm going to start with you. There have been revelations over the last several months that the government is engaging in electronic surveillance without seeking a court order under the FISA Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act. And a lot of the debate, and there's been considerable debate, has focused on the president's authority and separation of powers and so on, and we can get into that later. But for the moment, I guess I'd like to go sort of broader than that. What, if anything, is so troubling about the alleged surveillance program, and why has it become this issue of controversy?
Well, you know, I think that there are many things that you could say that are wrong about it, one of which, of course, is that it's in a way premised on this notion that the rules that guide the intelligence agencies in their activity, that guide the government, are somehow ineffective or inefficient or create inefficiencies in the government. To some extent, that's true, although certainly the purpose of those rules is just as much to produce a reliable, a focused government decision-making and to guide the intelligence agencies in their activities. What's disturbing about what the president has done here is to believe that he can somehow strengthen the national security by cutting the intelligence agencies loose from these rules. We know that even people of good intent working under pressure, and I would put in that category most of the government officials working on national security matters, people of good intent working under pressure make mistakes and cut corners and come up with wrong decisions. And the purpose of these rules is to create a system of checks and balances in order to produce a better outcome. And I fear that we are weakening our national security in addition to eroding privacy and trust and a sense of freedom of association. After all, it's, as you said, become nothing but a more global world. So many people now have business relationships abroad, affinities abroad. Even if these programs were limited to international communications, and I think it's pretty clear that they're not, but even if they were, that encompasses a large part of the American population engaging in legitimate conduct. The fear that I have, though, it's an interesting question to discuss. What do we fear about these technologies? Is it that we fear that the government will know everything about us, or is it that we fear that the government will know a little bit about us and draw false inferences from that? You know, at some level, you could say, well, if the government knew everything about you, they'd know that I'm a, you know, flawed but basically decent person, and it'd be okay. What I'm afraid of is that they don't know everything about me and that they would take the flaws and try to infer from them that I'm a bad person. And when you cut off the rules, and what we've had, of course, is a loosening of the rules on both sides, a loosening of the rules on the collection side, and then a loosening of the rules on the use side. You know, at this point here, the best thing that could happen to you almost is that you get charged with a crime. At least you get into a court, and you have all the protections of the Bill of Rights. But the government has set up this whole system outside of the criminal justice process and obviously tried to create this law-free zone at Guantanamo and elsewhere, where there's no checks and balances on the back end of the process either. And so then I think you really do get the worst of both worlds from a security standpoint as well as from a human rights standpoint.
Thank you, Jim. Kate, the president has said that this surveillance program is limited to calls between members or associates of al-Qaeda and people in the United States and, as Jim suggested, only reflects international calls. Aren't there suspicions that, in fact, the current program is far broader?
Well, there are suspicions. My suspicion about the program is that at the moment, It's focused not so much on listening to actual telephone conversations as on traffic analysis, which is that they record the phone numbers of everybody calling you and everybody you're calling, and then do a traffic analysis of who's talking to whom how many times, which now they can overlay on top of their computer databases, which include all information that's accessible to you, that's available about you from credit card companies, from public records, and from lots of different databases, and so assemble a picture of a lot of things about you. And I don't know if it's that Jim has a much more optimistic view of human nature than I do, but you know what Stalin's KGB chief said was, show me the man and I'll show you the crime. And I think that I would argue that we don't want to trust the government with all information about ourselves, even if we do happen to be decent but flawed people. And that the Privacy Act, it's interesting if you go back and look at it, Senator Ervin, the chief architect of the Privacy Act, said that the point of the Privacy Act was that the more the government knows about us, the more power it has over us. And the basic premise of the Privacy Act was to prevent the construction of a giant government-wide database that had information about everybody, about everything. And that basic premise has been disavowed since 9/11, and all of the rules that were put into place to implement that basic idea have been systematically eliminated in the Patriot Act, in the Intelligence Authorization Act, et cetera. And then the bureaucratic kind of distinctions that were also meant to ensure that the FBI's database was not available to the CIA or the DOD has also been eroded.
So in other words, the Privacy Act actually created silos, and now all we talk about is tearing silos down. We've referenced the Privacy Act, the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act. They were each passed in the 1970s in response, among other things, to the Church Committee hearings. That was sort of the last time I think we had such a debate on these issues. Arye Nair was on the front lines during that debate, and I wonder if you could give us your perspective of that debate, what issues it resolved, and what issues remain or are now raising their head again.
Well, I would say that the true age of surveillance in the United States was an earlier era than this one. Starting in the early years of the 20th century, there got to be a huge industry in the collection of data on political associations, but also on other kinds of activities that were in some way seen as discreditable. Every urban police department in the United States, for example, had a red squad in that era. In New York City, where I live, it was called the Bureau of Special Services. And by the time a lawsuit was brought in the late 1970s to dismantle the Bureau of Special Services, it had files on a million persons in New York City, some of them no longer alive. Chicago had 400,000 files in its data bank. In that period, in the late 1970s and the early 1980s, much of that surveillance system was dismantled through litigation at the local level, but also at the national level. In addition to the FISA law and the Privacy Act, there were other laws that were adopted in roughly the same era that also made significant contributions to the protection of privacy. There was the Fair Credit Reporting Act adopted in 1971. And before that, credit bureaus in the United States were a major source of discreditable information that was used to screen out individuals from potential employment. There was the Family Education Rights and Privacy Act, introduced by a right-wing member of the U.S. Senate, Senator James Buckley, and adopted in 1974. A number of these laws were adopted in 1974, right after Richard Nixon was forced to resign over Watergate. That was a kind of high point of concern with privacy in the United States. But before that, school records, anecdotal records by teachers and school psychologists stigmatized large numbers of children and made their way to employers and prevented their hiring. So we had a period from about 1975 to about 1985 in which a significant part of the system of collection of information, discreditable information on individuals, political and non-political, was dismantled. Not everything was dismantled. Arrest records, which have been the most harmful of all categories of records, remained as they were. Laws against their circulation, notwithstanding, they have circulated freely all the time. Medical records were not dealt with during this period. But we had achieved a great deal, and now I see a lot of the achievements of that era unraveling with the current era driven by the concern about terrorism, as if the concern about terrorism really matched the danger that we faced during the Cold War era when our antagonist, the Soviet Union, had a vast nuclear arsenal, when we were always a hair's breadth away from nuclear conflict, and yet terrorism has seemed so intimidating to so many people that it has superseded even the dangers of the Cold War as a kind of rationale for a revival of the data collection that we had dealt with to some degree in that era.
Jeff, of course, you've written on this, but is Aryeh right that the gains of an earlier era are being eroded, and particularly since 9/11, in your view?
Well, with apologies to the Open Society Institute, this is the worst possible week for you to have your 10th anniversary. I've spent the past 5 years since 9/11 arguing that it really is not as bad as it might have been, that as if only the political system would step up to the plate, if Congress would finally debate these issues, then perhaps there's some chance of it striking a sensible balance between liberty and security. And lo and behold, last week, the Congress, finally forced to act by the Supreme Court, passed that awful Military Commissions Act, which calls the thesis into question. But in the spirit of optimism, since it's 4:30 in the afternoon and too early to really... No, but I do have to defend my thesis, because otherwise I'm going to have to write another book, and that would be more than anyone wants to read right now. Maybe things aren't so bad. So first I'll give you the optimistic scenario since 9/11 for why Congress really did much less bad than they might have done, and certainly better than they did in 1917 and 1918, during the era that IRA mentioned when they passed the Espionage Act. Although if Jeff Stone's wonderful new book on the First Amendment is right, even the 1917 Congress wasn't so bad and drew distinctions requiring an imminent threat of serious harm that illiberal judges ignored. Stone's argument is actually Congress struck a better balance, and his broad thesis, which I enthusiastically embrace, is that civil liberties have always been more reliably protected in Congress than in the courts, a contrarian but I think persuasive thesis. So what's the happy news since 9/11? Let me give one example, which for me is encouraging. The evolution of the computer-assisted passenger profiling scheme. It sounds like an obscure program, but in fact, in its initial incarnation, this program was a privacy Chernobyl. The government proposed, essentially, to unite all of the data that's held by public and private databases, to run vast data mining programs, and to classify travelers at airports based on their perceived resemblance to the 9/11 terrorists. So people who didn't look like the 9/11 terrorists would get a green and go straight through. If you looked like Muhammad Atta, you'd be ranked red and taken to a back room and bludgeoned or something like that. In its original form, the CAPS program had only two problems. It wasn't going to work, and it posed great threats to privacy. But aside from that, Mrs. Lincoln, it was a really good program. The fact that it wasn't going to work is obvious to anyone who fears that the next attack is going to look nothing like the last one. And if you, for that reason, are profiling people who bought lots of fertilizer and took flying lessons in Florida, you may get a lot of retired businessmen with a passion for gardening, but not a lot of terrorists, which is why the whole idea of that sort of predictive profiling is flawed conceptually. And the privacy fears are well known, and they're embodied by the kind of fears that RA was talking about, encapsulated by the idea of the Nixon effect. If the government has access to all of the data of all citizens, it can go after its enemies and critics the way Nixon did after Vietnam protesters and threaten them with prosecution for tax evasion. Something very interesting happened when the CAPS program was proposed in its bad form. An unusual bipartisan coalition, again in the spirit that RA talked about when he noted Senator Buckley's work in this area, this time it was civil libertarian liberals and libertarian conservatives objected, and the government listened. It listened. There were two important changes made in the CAPS program. First, the program was changed from one that engaged in predictive profiling and tried to figure out who looked like Muhammad Atta, and instead of trying to identify suspicious terrorists, it only proposed to authenticate that people are who they say they are. So I go to the airport, the system confirms that I'm Jeff, that I have a stable identity, but it doesn't ask whether I took flying lessons or am likely to be a terrorist. That's a good thing for privacy. The second thing that the system did is even more impressive to me. It imposed controls on the use of data. First, the government said the data couldn't be shared unless there was evidence of an outstanding warrant for a violent crime or felony. That's a great idea, and that's what the Germans did, both after the Nazi and communist era. They gave their intelligence service broad authority to search, but they wouldn't allow data to be introduced in court unless it related to terrorism or violent crimes. For me, that idea of the control use model is one of the best protections for privacy in an age of surveillance, and I was delighted that the government imposed it. But even that wasn't enough for the civil libertarian critics. They said still you might have data shared if felonies, but not really serious felonies, were involved. After all, there are a lot of felonies nowadays. And in response to that criticism, the government capitulated further and at one point said, all right, the data will not be shared for any purpose. Well, you'll check in at the airport, the system will confirm that you are who you say you are, but it can't be used to find whether you have youthful marijuana arrests or anything else. That's a spectacular achievement, and that's something that we as civil libertarians should celebrate. With all of the proper criticisms and concern about the balance, when a program is proposed in a bad form and is refined so that it looks good, we should give both sides, the government and the critics, credit where credit is due. Similarly, and very briefly, the program to expand surveillance cameras. Originally proposed after 9/11, it was going to be a British-style system that would link thousands of cameras on the mall and be used at all times in ways that had nothing to do with terrorism. Again, the Open Society Institute, the Constitution Project, with Joe's leadership and the Civil Libertarian Coalition objected. And at one point, the system was limited so that it would only be turned on in response to specific threats. The tapes wouldn't be kept for a long period of time. And all of the controls on the use of data that are effective in protecting civil liberties were initially implicated. Now, that, too, was a Pyrrhic victory. After the crime wave this summer, D.C. has just proposed to start putting the cameras up throughout the neighborhoods, including in mine. And that persuaded me of the fragility of the compromise. And now we have this terrorist bill. So what to make of the future and how to defend this idea that, in the end, the political branches are not incapable of striking a good balance? Well, let's check in with each other after the midterm elections. But I'm cautiously optimistic that that really dreadful FISA bill, which in some ways was worse than the Military Commission bill, won't pass if the Democrats take Congress. And it's also the fact that in America, for better or for worse, there's a far stronger coalition against domestic surveillance than against the surveillance and interrogation of foreigners. You may not like that political reality. Europe certainly is appalled by our willingness to impose indignities on aliens that we won't impose on citizens, but it's a very real part of the politics of this debate. It's libertarian conservatives who really don't care about Guantanamo sometimes care quite a bit about domestic surveillance. And that's why I'm cautiously optimistic that the FISA bill won't pass. And if it remains the case that the worst thing Congress has done is repeal habeas corpus for aliens held abroad, not in the United States, who are suspected enemy combatants, I still will not entirely abandon hope in the American political system.
Thank you, Jeff. When we think of surveillance, we usually think of cameras, wiretap devices, a lot of the devices which you'll be able to see in this museum if they let you wander around. But in fact, there are other forms of surveillance, and they too are being dramatically impacted by technology. Jan Lori, I wonder if you could just begin by telling us about the Italian parliamentarians, just as an amusing story.
That's prompted, of course. I'm sure you know that. I'm an expert on the Italian parliament. Recently, the Italian parliament was adjourned, and waiting for them right outside of the building were a number of reporters who wanted to grab them to talk about intricacies of the new Italian budget. And they were mobbed by the reporters and cameras, and a person with a makeup sponge came up and dabbed everybody's forehead. And it was a setup. It was a totally surreptitious event intended to gather sweat from the brows of these hardworking politicians. And what they found was 16 of the 50 members of the Italian parliament tested positive for either cocaine or marijuana. I don't know why that's important, but I guess it's an interesting story and interesting to imagine happening here in the United States, and I appreciate Joe feeding it to me so I could get started with that.
Well, I think it's important, obviously not in and of itself, but because there is another kind of surveillance. It is surveillance of physical data, and the fact of the matter is, and Janor, I hope you'll talk about this more, that with a spot of blood or hair, one single hair, the technology is now there to learn an extraordinary amount about any individual. And, Janor, why don't we talk about that more seriously?
I think Jeff's comment is an interesting one because, as most of you know and as most of the people up here on the panel know, the only reason there has been any correction of any of the proposals that we've seen in the years after 9/11 is due to the efforts of people here. This is not just done because we have a beautiful system of checks and balances, unfortunately, and people have been working extremely hard to create some corrective measure so that we don't have all of our gains lost, as Aria pointed out. We had made tremendous gains in the 70s around privacy and surveillance. What I've been focusing on for the last few years is medical privacy. And in that area, there have been two major expansions around surveillance and intrusion that have even at times shocked me. And I am also someone who maintains a fair amount of hope and optimism, but these two recent programs I'll tell you about are fairly out of control and unfettered. One involves what is called syndromic surveillance. So post 9/11, there was a concern about a potential bioterrorist event. There was a concern that if we had an event, we wouldn't know how to prevent it. We wouldn't know how to anticipate it or to treat people who might have been hurt. We wouldn't know how to find out where the dirty bomb came from, or the anthrax, or SARS. And so around the country, in various cities that were considered targets, syndromic surveillance systems were developed. So it's not just about blood and hair now. Every time you go to an emergency room, or you call 911, or you call in sick for work at a major company, OSI I'm sure is not one of them, or you are absent from school, information is directly reported on a mandatory basis to the city Department of Health. This is happening in New York. It's happening in Los Angeles, in Boston, Indianapolis. And the Department of Health is analyzing the data to see if it gives information about a potential bioterrorist event that either has already occurred or that is giving signs that something could be happening. So anthrax on somebody could be an indication that they are involved with anthrax and involved in some kind of a plot. Now, there's been almost no public light shed on these initiatives. What has been happening, though, is a number of the city departments of health have been very concerned that they have all this data, and they don't necessarily know what to do with it. It's not as though they analyze it in real time and say, oh, these hospital admissions or these emergency room admissions. So now we know we've analyzed it for a set of syndromes, such as high fever or diarrhea or a certain kind of sore. We've analyzed the data. Today we didn't find a bioterrorist event. We should get rid of the data, and we'll look again tomorrow. That's not what's happening. They're collecting the data and storing it. And, of course, now, because the systems cost so much money to create and cost so much money to run, people have started to say, is there a dual use for the data? It's just this beautiful euphemism around dual use. Maybe we could use it for research. Maybe we could use it for marketing. Maybe we could use it to help better understand diseases in our city. Well, that's all well and good, but of course the systems were set up to guard against and respond to a potential bioterrorist event. So in the designing of the systems, in the planning of the systems, no legal constraints were put in place. If you were designing a system that was intended to instantly capture all emergency room visits or hospital admissions, you would design it in a way that had some of those safeguards built in, privacy and security safeguards, if you were to design it. But this, of course, was not the case. Everything was done in a crisis. We had an emergency around a potential bioterrorist event, so there have been no constraints. And now the CDC and others are talking about dual use. And I like to talk about triple use and quadruple use because the data is so valuable, everybody wants access to it. The thing that's been most disturbing about syndromic surveillance is 6 months ago, the CDC announced a new twist on it. They want the information directly reported to the CDC, not going through the public health departments, which in most states and cities have some sense that they're the good guys with the white jackets or the white hats and they're here to protect us. The CDC is not necessarily seen that way by the state and local public health departments, and they essentially are part of the federal government. And they now want to bypass the local authorities because they don't believe they can get accurate data. The local authorities don't want to give up their data. So they are now contracting with hospitals and emergency rooms and others to report it directly to the CDC. They're calling this program BioSense. And they have refused to accept any limitations on the use of the data, the secondary use of the data, whether any other agency at the federal government, such as Homeland Security, could have access. So this is a serious problem. The second, that's kind of all lumped under syndromic surveillance. The second kind of big medical privacy issue right now, and this also stems from an initiative in New York City and the CDC, is to start to move ahead with mandatory reporting of certain kinds of conditions. So many of you may remember in the 80s we made some progress around HIV/AIDS in terms of civil liberties safeguards. There have been informed consent requirements at the states, pretest counseling guidelines at the states. Those have been pretty much across the board. What New York City has now proposed is getting rid of those informed consent and pretest counseling guidelines. Why? Because they want to move to routine testing of all people for HIV. Because it is true that there are a number of people, not a huge percentage, but a significant percentage of people who are HIV positive and don't know it because their doctors don't think they're at risk. So the solution that the state has come up with is to routinize testing, and the informed consent and pretest counseling rules are in the way. They're barriers to testing. So let's just get rid of those barriers, have the testing, and then have it reported to the city. Okay, that's one little piece of it. The second part is intervention in the doctor-patient relationship. For the first time, what the city wants to do is to directly contact doctors treating people with HIV and AIDS to make sure that they are giving the proper treatment. They also are planning to do this with diabetes, first time ever for a non-contagious condition for which we would not consider it an epidemic. They want to have mandatory reporting, and it's happening now, of A1C levels of all people in the city of New York, and they want to do a pilot project in the South Bronx where you have a large percentage of low-income and people of color who are developing diabetes at a higher rate and have direct intervention into the healthcare of those people. So it's the first time ever that we're seeing this link between mandatory reporting, surveillance, and intervention. Why is this part of the national debate? Because the CDC is now issuing guidelines very consistent with what we're seeing in New York. New York, in some ways, has become a testing ground for a number of these public health initiatives. So in the healthcare arena, where we know it's not just about medical information, but your health record essentially contains financial data, credit data, family history, genetic information, all kinds of information, your location, your social security number. So the government is now becoming a massive collector of this information and believes that it has the kind of medical know-how or credibility to step into the doctor-patient relationship. So those are the two things that have been justified kind of post 9/11 as crises and epidemics in a way that has really undermined progress that we had made in this area.
Thank you, Jen. I said earlier that massive surveillance challenges or poses a challenge to our values in several respects, and I would like now to turn specific attention to them, although they've already been mentioned in passing. One, clearly, is that when you have massive surveillance, that information can be used in ways which are discriminatory. And I'd like to begin to address that by asking Kate an obvious question: who is now being surveyed post 9/11, and what are the discrimination dangers that it poses?
Well, I think that this is actually the most important and worrisome aspect of the increasing surveillance, because while I'm agree with Jeff about the progress that was made on the airport surveillance and on the CAPS no-fly list, I think that, in fact, what's happened is that we have increasingly a system of the secret collection of information being secretly housed in databases, mostly at the Department of Defense, which has billions of dollars more than any other agency, and being data mined. And it's being data mined to find terrorists. And when you talk to people in the intelligence and defense and law enforcement community and ask them, so where is the legal prohibition against the National Security Advisor asking the FBI or the DOD to give her a list of, oh, the top 10,000 Muslim Americans in this country who might be considered a threat or who might merit further investigation? And the answer is there is no such legal prohibition anywhere in the law. And I think that's one basic problem, is that it's clearly aimed at surveillance and targeting of Muslim and Arabs in this country. But that it's not simply a question of surveillance, and that we've already seen examples, and that we will see more and more examples of people being prosecuted as a result of the surveillance, of people being deported as a result of the surveillance, and people being denied employment as a result of the surveillance, when there is no evidence that they are in fact terrorists. And that is the greatest danger I see from what's happening in this country. And that, of course, we've seen it already not only with immigrant communities more generally, but we also see it to some degree with the anti-war movement in this country.
Jeff, obviously, if you survey carefully any group of people, you're going to find that they commit crimes that everybody else commits, but you only see it at the people you look at. The one crime that I think is universal in this country, although maybe Muslims are underrepresented, is the illegal driver's licenses between the ages of 18 and 21. And whatever group you look at, you'll find it. Obviously, many people commit immigration and other offenses. And if you only look at any subsection of the population, they are going to end up being disproportionately prosecuted or deported. What can be done about that? I noted that Judge Posner, although he's an advocate of much, much wider surveillance, said, well, of course, it should only be used for terrorism. Is that workable? Is that the way the system traditionally works? How can we, in fact, channel or control the use of information?
Yes, the greatest invitation to racial profiling in this country are two cases that intersect in an odd way that were decided before the Supreme Court. One is the case that said that pretext is not an offense under the law. If the cops stop you because they say you have a broken taillight, but they really suspect that you're an African American who might be using drugs, that's no problem. They can arrest you, do the general search, and find the drugs. The second case was the Atwater case. That was the lady who was driving without a seatbelt for her kids. The cops arrested her for not having a seatbelt. The kids are weeping. You know, she's sent to jail. She says this is an unreasonable search because it's disproportionate. Being arrested for a statutory offense of not having a seatbelt is an unreasonable search and seizure. And the court, in an unfortunate decision written by Justice Souter, of all people, said as long as there's authority to arrest, the arrest is permissible no matter how minor the offense. So the intersection of those two doctrines makes possible the kind of broad profiling that Kate is talking about. What could be done? You could change the doctrine. You could reverse, in theory, either of those decisions and say there are some kinds of indignities, seizures that are disproportionate to the underlying crime at hand. Courts used to do that in the 18th century when they said that you couldn't search private diaries to prosecute John Wilkes for seditious libel because seditious libel wasn't a serious enough crime to justify the invasiveness of a diary search, but the courts have gone in very much the other direction. Short of reversing Supreme Court cases that are unlikely to be reversed, you could embrace a model of the kind that, Posner came late to it, Bill Stuntz, and at Harvard and I, for what it's worth, were peddling this idea a couple years ago, the control use model, as the Germans embraced. Yes, the intelligence services have broad access to data. It can be collected for lots of reasons, but it can't be shared except to stop terrorism or violent crimes. The problem with this is that there's no political constituency for imposing the control use model. I was very distressed to learn from the German Privacy Commissioner recently that even Germany is thinking of abandoning this very longstanding prohibition and relaxing the controls on the use of data. And as for America, efforts to impose little controls on use, despite the success of CAPS, have foundered on the government's claim that the entire focus of the prevention paradigm since 9/11 is a large version of the Al Capone effect. They say we have to stop crime before serious crime occurs. Therefore, we need to go after the terrorists for lower-level crimes to prevent them from committing bigger ones, just like as the government prosecuted Capone for tax evasion because they couldn't quite prove he was a mobster. The problem with the Al Capone effect when applied to terrorists is it was pretty obvious that Capone was a mobster. It just couldn't prove it beyond reasonable doubt. In the 9/11 context, you have lots of people who are arrested for cigarette smuggling or for minor offenses who may be nothing more than cigarette smugglers but have been targeted because the government thinks they're terrorists. What's the solution to this? I think it's a version of the old FISA law. Essentially, you have broad authority to search without probable cause, as long as you're pretty sure in advance that someone is a really bad person, a suspected spy or terrorist. That's what makes Section 215 of the Patriot Act so unsettling, because it expands the range of documents that can be searched regardless of whether the individual is very suspicious. And that's what makes the current FISA debate so disheartening, and why I fear when you see even Senator Specter, the unexpected moral conscience when it comes to Abu Ghraib, although he then said, although I think this bill is unconstitutional, I'll sign it anyway and the Supreme Court can figure it out. That's a good approach to your oath of office to uphold the Constitution. But despite his concerns about the military commissions issue, he showed none about domestic surveillance. So I fear that this may be an area where there is a theoretical solution, but there's not a political constituency. History is not encouraging about controls on the use of data having kept, and for that reason, this is one area where I'm not all that optimistic.
Jim, the Markle Foundation brought together a wide range of people. Did they reach any consensus on this issue, or as Jeff said, is this an issue that was left open by Markle?
Well, you know, it's a little bit like all those GAO reports that are headlined. Progress has been made, but more work needs to be done. You know, let me say before I go any further that this is, I think, a program and reception to mark the 10th anniversary of the U.S. programs of OSI, and nobody has even mentioned yet the significance of the work that OSI has done internationally and domestically. Obviously, REA is not a mere panelist here, but the president of the Open Society Institute and Mort Halperin, the head of the Washington office of OSI, is here. And a lot of us have been funded and nurtured by the generosity of OSI over the years. And we do have a community which has, I think, made a difference. In some ways, I think if you look historically, this, I don't know, I'll go out on a limb and say we haven't had anything as bad as the Japanese internment. Guantanamo is a serious blot on America's, a serious blot on America, but I think we do have this community of advocates, and we're continuing to sort of struggle on these issues. Now, one of the things that OSI stood for and still stands for is that there's something unique and powerful and good about this technology, that this sort of information technology revolution that we've experienced in the past 15 years or so. Certainly, the Open Society Institute felt that it was important, for example, to bring the Internet to the then Soviet Union and then ultimately to the countries or republics of the former Soviet Union, and that we have here this technology of it's open and global and decentralized and abundant and expensive, user-controlled in some unique way. And I think we have it's worth thinking about as we talk about these almost inexorable trends of technology and identity and sensor networks and storage and location awareness and these other the analytic capabilities that can be summed up under data mining. If we think about all those trends of the technology, I think it's important to look at and keep in mind the positive aspects of this technology and figure out, you know, what does it take to sort of promote the user-controlled elements of the technology. I think it's fair to say that since 9/11, the pendulum has swung and the government has put its thumb on the scales of the technology development and has sort of put its funding behind technology development that has, I think, swung things in a negative regard. I think it's worth thinking about, in addition to the sort of checks and balances, and at the end of the day, we probably have nothing left other than that. I think it all comes down to due process. I think we're not going to turn back the tide of the technology. I think we're not going to be able to say that there's any technology that the government can't have or can't use. So we're only talking about the rules for its use. But then I think also we want to look at going back to some of these principles of user control and how can the technology be used for greater transparency and how can you build the technologies. For example, another rule, in addition to the rules that Jeff Rosen just cited, is the basic rule that once the government has it, it can keep it forever. And certainly in the law enforcement context, if you search somebody's house and you don't find the crime you were looking for but find a different crime, you can use it. You can keep that information forever. Now the wall is down. One of the things that the Markle Task Force tried to grapple with was this question of how can we use the technology and the policy to enhance civil liberties, particularly privacy. And I don't think we're close to having the answer there. I think that the Markle Task Force wouldn't pretend to have the answer. I think it has to be certainly part of the solution. How do you design the technology so that the government can serve its legitimate needs, but we can build in some of the controls that used to be obtained by what we all know as privacy by obscurity? Can we now have more mandatory design features into technology that protect privacy? The government is clearly trying to push it in the other way and promote the technology, intrusive aspects of this technology. I'm not necessarily optimistic about where that'll go, I'm afraid.
Kate spoke about discrimination with respect to Muslims and Arabs, but I think that the technology and surveillance can lead to at least several other kinds of discrimination. Arye alluded to one when he spoke about arrest records. Obviously, the indiscriminate use of those records discriminates against minorities. Arye, do you want to speak any further on that issue? Because it's one that comes up just the other day. There was articles that many of you read that efforts to purge your records don't work because the records get out and are disseminated widely by private companies.
Yeah. Well, when Jeff cited a couple of Supreme Court decisions that do damage, I was thinking of a somewhat older case which essentially stands for the proposition that having collected data on you, the government can stigmatize you falsely and not be held accountable for it. And the case that I'm thinking of is Paul versus Davis, which was decided by the United States Supreme Court in 1976. And what happened in that case was a man named Davis, who was a reporter for the Louisville Courier Journal, was stopped in a department store for shoplifting. They apparently decided it was a mistake, and he was released, and that seemed to be that. And then sometime later, at the Christmas season, the police department circulated a flyer to stores listing known active shoplifters, and it had his name and his photograph in that flyer. And he found out about it, and he sued the police department, and the U.S. Supreme Court, in a decision written by Justice Rehnquist, said that he didn't have a cause of action for violation of his civil rights. The only remedy that he could have would be to file a defamation suit against the police department, knowing, I think, full well that public officials had immunity against such defamation suits. So essentially, if information has been gathered on you and it is circulated and, as I say, in this case, false information was used to stigmatize him, there really isn't any remedy that you have for it. Now, in the case of arrest records, theoretically, one is innocent until proven guilty. But it's quite easy to collect arrest records. There are about 10 million non-traffic arrests in the United States every year. But it's actually quite difficult to collect records of dispositions, because dispositions take place at various stages and in different ways. Somebody can plead guilty or they can be convicted. A charge can be dismissed by a prosecutor. A judge can dismiss a charge. A person can secure acquittal on appeal. So there are many different ways in which the disposition can take place. And there's no one moment in which a disposition is recorded. So usually dispositions don't catch up with arrest records. There are many statutes which purport to seal arrest records, but the problem is that once an arrest record is collected by a law enforcement agency, it disseminates the record to other agencies, and those agencies in turn disseminate the record to still other agencies. And so even though the record may be sealed, how do you catch up with all the places to which it has been disseminated? In fact, you can't. And so a fair number of people who have been arrested and know that their records are supposed to be erased or sealed answer questions on employment applications saying, no, I was not arrested. But the employer then finds out that, in fact, they were arrested. Then the person has lied in the job application, and that becomes a basis for not giving the person a job. Now, if you have a certain amount of racial profiling, and that's been around for a long time, then you know that minorities are going to be arrested disproportionately. If the consequence of their arrest is that they are going to have extra difficulties in employment or in getting licenses, say, to drive a taxi, or admissions to educational institutions, then what you're essentially saying is those persons are marginalized, and the arrest record becomes a kind of self-fulfilling prophecy, that it's precisely people who are not able to integrate into the mainstream of American society who are most likely to get arrested again and get convicted. And so arrest records have a particularly pernicious role in helping to create an underclass. And again, we're very efficient at collecting them. We're not very efficient at collecting the dispositions of arrest records.
Another group of people I think can be subject to discrimination are people with various physical or mental disabilities. Jan Laurie, how does the new ability to test and so on, how is that going to will that lead to even further potential discrimination against people with physical and mental illnesses?
Well, it's interesting because in the two initiatives that I talked about in New York City, one around diabetes and the other one around HIV/AIDS, both of those involved diseases and conditions that up until probably 10 or 15 years ago were mainly affected kind of white middle class or upper middle class populations or the kind of politically sophisticated population that grew up around AIDS in this country, white gay men. And what has happened is that both of those diseases have undergone big demographic shifts. And so certainly in New York now, the largest percentage of increases in the diagnoses of both of those conditions involve people of color, racial and ethnic minorities, low income. And so the idea that the city has and that the city health commissioner has is that you have mandatory reporting that is electronic from the labs. The doctors are not having to report, which they used to have to do. They used to have to report directly to the Department of Health. Now the labs do it automatically. They don't have a doctor-patient relationship. So they are required by law to report to the State Department of Health. And so while the idea of this, while the intention behind this is laudable, we are trying to get at populations that have, greater barriers to access to care, greater barriers to access to quality care. These are also populations that are at much higher risk for discrimination, for stigma. These are also two conditions, I'm sure it's not a coincidence, that are preventable. You can alter your behavior and not develop type 2 diabetes and not get HIV in a lot of situations. And the city has made it really clear that the idea is to educate people about improving their diet, getting better exercise, practicing safe sex, making sure that they get tested, informing their partners. So again, it's this focus on you as someone who might be to blame, might be at fault for developing your condition and causing the city to have to spend these resources. Because you hear a lot about how expensive it is and why the city has to intervene into the healthcare system. So just those groups that are at risk for lower quality care, disparities of care, as REA said, you've got this coming right into conflict with each other. Exactly those groups that are at higher risk for disparities are now also going to be at higher risk for discrimination and stigma. And they have very little control over it. They don't have a choice about whether the information is reported. They don't have a choice about whether the Department of Health contacts their doctor. So there's a real problem here about the technology making possible a certain public health initiative that might have a laudable purpose, but again, for which there are no limits and no controls and will probably have a discriminatory impact.
Can I ask another question, Jan Laurie? Testing will and already enables society to find out about genetic diseases. Increasingly, at least as I understand it, the testing will also be able to find out, and already in some cases already does, your predisposition to certain diseases. Aren't people who, for example, test as having a predisposition to breast cancer or alcoholism or other things, aren't they likely to be discriminated against by life insurers, health insurers, and others?
Well, they already are. I mean, most of the genetic testing that exists out there is about predisposition. It's not the single. There are very few genes we've been able to identify that are the single genes that you have or will develop with certainty this condition. Most of it is a predisposition. You have a 30% likelihood if you look at the environmental or heredity factors. And most people are getting genetic testing and paying out of pocket. They think if they don't file a claim, it doesn't go into their record. Or they're avoiding genetic tests where they could, if they had a test that showed they had a predisposition, they could then take preventive steps. There are things that they could do prophylactically to possibly limit their risk. But they're so nervous about having the information in their record. It's one of the areas where people are most likely to avoid testing and counseling and or pay out of pocket and insist to their doctor this information cannot be shared. At Columbia University at the hospital, one of the top geneticists there said she has had to create a whole separate system within the hospital against the hospital's wishes that keeps the information essentially, excuse the term, in a lockbox. It is not part of the hospital's electronic information sharing system. She promises her patients total confidentiality, otherwise they won't get the test. So, you know, again, we have this crazy collision in public policy around spending money to do this great scientific work and this great technological work, and people are afraid that it's going to limit their ability to get jobs and insurance or their children. Because with hereditary diseases, if you have a positive genetic test for predisposition, then you could make an inference that your children or your relatives, your biological relatives, may also have that predisposition.
In a few minutes, I'm going to open it to questions, but there is one other area that I would like to talk about briefly, and that is we talk about surveillance and different agencies doing surveillance. Does it make any difference which agencies they are? And in particular, does it make any difference if surveillance is done by the military or the CIA as opposed to domestic agencies? And I'll give at least one or two of you a chance to comment on that. As you know, we now have in our country for the first time an Army command for North America. That command, like all the other commands, the Southern Command and the Central Command, have large intelligence services. We have heard stories about that. Kate, I'll start with you. Does it make a difference? Should it make a difference? Why should we care whether surveillance is being undertaken by the military, let's say, as opposed to the FBI or local police forces?
Well, I think we've seen that the military has started to spy on Quakers, et cetera, and that we should care, and that the fundamental difference is that for all of the FBI's faults, when the FBI investigates individuals or groups, it has in mind, do we have some information indicating that that individual or group is engaged in some kind of terrorist or criminal activity? And that the whole approach of the Defense Department, especially in its domestic surveillance, is the opposite. What they've done is put together a system that enables them to receive all the information that's collected about everyone in all the different databases, have the DOD access that, have the DOD have the technological tools to data mine it, and then send it back out, not just to other intelligence agencies, but to the Department of Homeland Security, where it's used against immigrants, and to the state and local police departments around the country. So what you're talking about, and only the Defense Department, I believe, has the resources and the money and the wherewithal to actually build such a system. And so what you're talking about, and this is where I wanted to, I'm just going to take this opportunity to make my radical suggestion I've been trying to make, is the government building, I think, not one giant database, but a system of linked databases that is meant to include all information available on everyone and is then going to be accessible to tens of thousands of individuals in law enforcement, in the White House, and in state and local police forces. And that the purpose of that is to find the, quote, terrorists in this country, which might number, I think if you ask the professionals, 500 people. I mean, it might number 200 people. But it doesn't number 10,000 people. There are not 10,000 terrorists in this country at the moment. It is some finite number. And so now we have all of these law enforcement, intelligence, et cetera, agencies with all of this information being told your top priority is to find terrorists. And they have this information, and I think that we have seen the beginnings, and we will see more and more of what that means is to find, under the Al Capone theory, Muslim Americans who, quote, or immigrants who, quote, look like terrorists. And that, in addition to the question of controls on use, which with Jeff I'm very pessimistic about, or the question of can we create technologies that enhance privacy and protect us, and I'm pessimistic about that vis-a-vis technologies having to do with protecting your privacy against the government versus against other private individuals, is I do think, this is my radical question, that we should have a debate in this country about whether or not we want the government to have those capabilities, and that I don't believe it's a necessary and for sure thing, because I think they will cost millions or hundreds of millions of dollars to build, and that if they will not necessarily be built by the private sector, and so that we can, in fact, perhaps at least postpone that build, the building of them.
Arye, you were involved in earlier battles with respect to Army spying. Do you want to just talk a little about Laird v. Tatum and related events?
The spying that took place in the 1960s and the early 1970s was motivated by something other than a concern with terrorism. The military had been called out quite frequently to deal with the urban riots of that era. And so the military decided it needed its own surveillance data, and about 1,500 personnel were used to collect information on groups that might be involved in urban riots. But, of course, they didn't stop there. One of the characteristics of data collection is there are always reasons to expand the kind of information that was collected. So they decided that they would also collect information on anti-war groups because those groups were opposed to the military. And eventually that information became known because an Army captain, Christopher Pyle, wrote an article for the Washington Monthly disclosing what he had been assigned to do and what other military personnel had been assigned to do in collecting such information. The lawsuit that the ACLU brought against the Army for the collection of such data was decided by the U.S. Supreme Court in 1972. It's called Laird versus Tatum. I mentioned Rehnquist earlier with respect to the Paul V. Davis case. Rehnquist had just joined the U.S. Supreme Court at that time. He had been nominated by Nixon after the Haynesworth and Carswell nominations crashed, and that's probably the only reason that it was possible for Nixon to secure the confirmation of Rehnquist so easily. The country was simply tired of rejecting nominees to the U.S. Supreme Court. As director of the Office of Legal Counsel for the Justice Department, Rehnquist had been the spokesperson for the Justice Department in defending military surveillance. He actually was a precursor to people like John Yoo in terms of his concept of presidential power. He said there was inherent presidential power to collect this information, and he testified before Senator Sam Ervin's Constitutional Rights subcommittee on that subject. And lo and behold, when he came onto the U.S. Supreme Court, the court got the case challenging the Army surveillance, and Rehnquist cast the deciding vote. It was a 5-4 decision, and the Supreme Court's rationale for saying that the plaintiffs did not have standing essentially tracked the arguments that that Rehnquist had made in his testimony before Senator Ervin's committee. We made an effort subsequently to require Rehnquist to recuse himself retroactively. I'm not sure that anything like that has ever been done on any other occasion in the U.S. Supreme Court. And he issued a 17-page opinion justifying his participation in the case, saying that if he had not participated, it would have been a 4-4 decision, which wouldn't have settled the legal issue. Of course, we won the case at the lower court level, so it would have affirmed that decision. And he agreed that reasonable people could differ whether it was appropriate for him to participate in the decision of that case. Anyway, that was the military spying of that era. There was earlier military spying during World War II. The military also engaged in political surveillance. One of those who was reportedly a target of military political surveillance in that era was Eleanor Roosevelt. So there have been various justifications at different times. It's one of these bad pennies that that keeps turning up again.
And speaking of bad pennies, the standing arguments are still haunting us. Those of you who are involved in the electronic surveillance cases, the various cases that have been brought to challenge the president's surveillance program, in each of those cases, of course, difficult standing issues are raised as well.
Can I add just one footnote? Even though we lost the case, the exposure of the Army surveillance program killed the program. And one thing which has to be done with respect to these surveillance programs is expose them, and expose them in all of what is often their folly, because that's, I think, the best means of curbing some of these surveillance programs.
Jim, briefly, and then we're going to go to the audience.
Yeah. To a person who only has a hammer, every problem looks like a nail. And to the country that has the world's largest military, I think every problem looks like a military problem. And I think that that's been one of the fundamental flaws in our whole approach to terrorism since 9/11. Clearly, there's an element of war to it, but I think war should not be the predominant metaphor, and we've allowed it to become the predominant metaphor. And until we get away from that, I think we're never going to get out of this problem. I think a related piece of that is that a fundamental misunderstanding of the role of intelligence and what intelligence means, and what is the right model for intelligence to address this terrorism problem. Kate has written about what I believe is correct, that the law enforcement model is a much more appropriate model for a lot of what we're facing, but we've headed down this sort of intelligence road. And anyhow, I think somehow if we're ever going to get out of this hole, we've got to break away from the war metaphor and at least, if not break away from the intelligence metaphor, better understand what we mean by intelligence.
Thank you, Jim. I'm now going to open it up. We have a microphone. Please give your name and organization. You do not have to give your mother's maiden name or Social Security number. Lily?
Is this one?
Okay. Yes, it is.
I'm Lily Comey with the Electronic Privacy Information Center. First, I want to thank OSI for allowing us to sit in this wonderful discussion and about privacy issues. I think it's probably one of the better formats I've seen engaging all the perspectives that you bring. And I do agree that our pushback collectively in our own areas on this issue has definitely led to more reflection on the Hill and revisiting of these issues. I wanted to ask a question specifically around the fact that surveillance is about control, fundamentally, and that all of the resources that have gone toward setting up this means of surveilling, looking for ostensibly what Kate says, maybe max 500 individuals, that in this country there's also this element of profit motivation, because a lot of it, if it's not the DOD, it's outsourced to third parties that are data brokers and provide services to law enforcement agencies in order to feed the flow of information on individuals in this country. That profit motivation may make the apparatus stay around a lot longer than the issue of terrorism, that there will be moves to try to look for other means to use this resource. And I think the nexus might be, if it's going to end up being used for law enforcement purposes, that you have marginalized communities where the exercise of First Amendment rights run the gambit. It's force that led to the Black Panther Party and Nation of Islam and other groups that arise to represent particular interests out there, and that if those groups fall into this net of surveillance for whatever reasons are determined to be threats, how are they going to be prepared for that? And then two, how do we become prepared for either challenging the privatization of the surveillance society, or do we try to bring the controls that should be in place into the private sector of those entities that are trying to sell this resource to the federal and state government?
Jeff, do you want to start addressing that question?
Yes, on the profit motive side of it, which is a very important question, it's no coincidence, obviously, that the guy who originally proposed a version of the Chernobyl cap system was Larry Ellison, who's the head of the Oracle Corporation, which is the largest database manufacturer in the United States. And he magnanimously offered to donate free Oracle software so that it would be at no cost to the United States government. Coincidentally, the upgrades and maintenance wouldn't be free. And the basis of his proposal was based on the idea that what's good for Oracle is good for America, and the possibility that there might be some values in the American Constitution that are not consistent with the profit motive, in particular the idea that while it's appropriate for companies to classify and rank their consumers so they can decide who's reliable, it's not appropriate for the U.S. government to classify and rank its citizens, alluded Mr. Ellison. Now, the problem, though, is not just economic, but political and cultural. Europe is much more concerned, as you know, about private sector surveillance than we are. And all of the European privacy laws are based on the idea that it's an affront against dignity for consumers to have their data shared. We're more concerned about state surveillance, and this has a long and fascinating history. So how to solve this problem in an age when it's very easy for private companies to make a lot of money by contracting out their services to the government, and for law enforcement to piggyback on these companies and to get data that they couldn't get directly, is a problem without a political solution, because those civil libertarian, the libertarian conservatives, my friends, you know, the heroes of the debate over Section 215, some of them did their best in that, are very opposed to data restriction laws because they tend to be free marketeers. So this is a really serious problem without an obvious solution.
Sure. Well, bear in mind that one of the very significant protections of privacy in the United States is the Fair Credit Reporting Act. And before the Fair Credit Reporting Act, and that's 35 years old now, credit bureaus essentially were the mechanism by which a lot of discreditable data was disseminated to employers in the United States. That has largely ended with the Fair Credit Reporting Act. The key provision of the Fair Credit Reporting Act is that you can get a copy of the credit report that a credit agency is disseminating about you. They have to give you the information. And once you can see that information, they know that they can't disseminate false information about you. So it has completely transformed that industry.
Lily properly raises the fact that obviously much information is held, indeed more information is maybe held privately than by government. And, of course, the key point is that that line is a very porous one because, as Jeff indicated, the government can get it by contract, or it can get it under Section 215 of the Patriot Act if it's terrorist-related, or it can get it through grand jury subpoenas, so that anything that the private sector has is available one way or another to the government. Other questions? Caroline?
I'm Caroline Frederickson with the ACLU, and I was very interested in what Arye had to say about the Cold War and sort of the relative threat assessments, and seeing my friend from Cato, Jim Harper, here. It sort of made me think about how sort of out of whack the American public is right now in terms of the true threat posed by terrorism and the reaction, or overreaction, as we might call it, in terms of law enforcement, the new laws, the way that all the extensive surveillance that's going on, potentially the loads of resources that are being put into a variety of security measures. And I'm just wondering whether you think that that's not true, and in fact we are sort of at the appropriate threat risk assessment, or if not, which tends to be sort of where my perspective would be, how do we sort of recalibrate and bring the American public back into a sort of more realistic assessment of what truly our risks are in terms of terrorism?
Are you, do you want to take a first crack at that?
I wish I knew how to answer that question. You know, when the Cold War was underway, it wasn't only that there was this enormous threat, and it literally could have been the end of a civilization. But there were also these actual shooting wars that were underway throughout the world. It was an immensely dangerous period. And there were very significant justifications that were offered for the collection of information. These people were subversives. They were going to undermine our side in this global struggle. Incidentally, one footnote on that: there was a period in which the FBI was largely out of the business of collecting political data. It was out of it from about 1924 when Coolidge was president, because Attorney General Holland Fisk Stone essentially told J. Edgar Hoover that he had to stop collecting this information. And the president who put the FBI back into that business was Franklin Delano Roosevelt. He gave Hoover an instruction to collect subversive information at the point that the United States was not yet engaged in the war in Europe, but the prospect of American engagement was becoming greater. And thereafter, every time J. Edgar Hoover would go to Capitol Hill to argue for the budget for the FBI, he would always, early in his testimony, cite Roosevelt's instructions as the basis for the FBI's collection of the information. There was not actual legislative authority for the FBI to collect all of that political surveillance data. But, you know, we got through that Cold War era. And ultimately, the political surveillance data doesn't seem to have been a significant factor in getting us through it. You can go through all of the immense amount of political surveillance collection that took place in that era, and the actual products of it in terms of, you know, people who were prosecuted and convicted of espionage or sabotage is negligible. There's really very little that was accomplished with all of that. And the question is, are we accomplishing more today with this data? Inevitably, officials have to overreact, because they cannot be accused of neglecting something if something in fact does happen. And therefore, there is this tremendous tendency to collect vastly more than is actually useful and actually required. But arguing all of this, it seems to me, is extremely difficult. It was difficult in those days. It's difficult today. One has to do the best one can, but I don't know a solution.
Jim, do you want to say something?
I think this is a critical question, and I've been thinking about it a little bit. Prompted by, I don't know if many of you saw, on 9/10, Ted Koppel had this special, and I was in the audience, and I never got called on. I tried to insert myself. And it was very frustrating, and one of the reasons, trying to think about it afterwards, one of the reasons why it was frustrating is because partly I think this debate arguably can only be played out by the political forces. And I was there, and all of the administration defenders were largely people who currently work in private law practice. And I was there as a representative of a 501c3, and I felt constrained against saying political type things. And I was there as a nonpartisan organization, and I felt constrained about saying things rightly or wrongly. And they felt no constraint at all, and they were just right on down the line defending the president. But secondly, you know, you've seen the recent interviews that the president has given to various journalists, the one-on-ones. And he always says, these people want to kill you, and they want to kill your family. Now, I think the right answer to that is not, they don't want to kill my family. Because, in a way, you know, you got to worry about it when you get on the airplane, and I think people worry about it. I worry about it when my kids fly. Okay, they want to kill my family, but that's no reason to panic. No, I think 95% of the problems we've faced in the past 6 years, 5 years, have been due to panic and arrogance. And if you think about it, it comes down to panic and arrogance. The people in charge panicked after 9/11, and there was really no ground for panic. And I don't think you have to minimize the threat at all in order to say that you shouldn't have panicked, and they did. And they cast aside a lot of fundamental principles that a lot of people had spent a long time on both sides of the aisle building up over 30 or 40 years in the history that REA talks about. During this Koppel thing, a couple of the administration defenders kept talking about 9/11 as representing an existential threat. Now, that is clearly overblown. There is no way that the terrorists threaten the existence of the United States. They do threaten my family. They threaten me. There's that personal level of threat. But it's clearly not an existential threat. But by the same token, I don't want to go down the road of is it 500, is it 1,000, is it 10,000? I mean, there are always going to be people who say, you know, you're wrong, I know the answer, but if I told you, I'd have to kill you kind of thing. And so you always get into that debate. But I think we can say this is not a ground to panic. And however big this threat is, and what makes this a little different from 20 years ago is sort of the privatization of the means of mass destruction. So, I mean, you clearly have the biochemical threat. I think you cannot underestimate that threat. You can overestimate that threat, but you cannot eliminate that threat. So I really think that the right way to think about this is to say, yeah, there's a threat, but it does not merit casting aside fundamental human rights principles and the rule of law and this whole framework of rules that we have built up. I mean, why do we have uniformed military officers opposing the President of the United States on military tribunals in Guantanamo and the rules here? It's because they were good for the military, too. And they were good for our country, and they're good for national security. And that the people in charge panicked, and they cast aside things that were good for national security.
Thank you. Ginny?
Hi, Jim. Jenny Sloan with the Constitution Project. And Jeff, you mentioned our video surveillance work, and it reminded me of the program where we released our guidelines, and there was a police officer from Philadelphia there who commented that if law enforcement is given toys to play with, they're not going to say no. They're just going to keep accepting more and more toys, and there'll be very little constraint on their use. And it also reminded me of the time that we took that tour of the D.C. police headquarters, their surveillance headquarters, which was, I thought, truly terrifying. And we saw a lot of things that they were using now, but also some things that they hope to use in the future. And so I was wondering whether the panelists in each of the areas you've discussed could give us some idea of what's in store for us in 10 years or 20 years in terms of, or even farther out, in terms of the technology that can be used to invade our privacy.
Jeff, do you want to talk about video surveillance at least? And other things as well?
Well, it's pretty dystopian. You can certainly imagine, and it's not that far away, because even in London, they were hoping to implement this stuff pretty quickly. You can imagine a version of ubiquitous surveillance where I leave the house in the morning, cameras track me at every stage of my trip to work on the subway, behavioral recognition analysis, and gait recognition tries to figure out whether I'm suspicious. And then this is the stuff I'm just looking at now. Brain scans look at my brain waves, figure out whether I have a predisposition to violence or whether I am likely to have the brain patterns of a suspected terrorist. And I'm indefinitely, just before I reach work, I'm indefinitely detained for 300 years at Guantanamo because my brain looks bad. Or if the government doesn't want to do that in real time, it could go back in 5 years and forward click on me, back click to where I've gone to, forward click on where I'm going to, and basically make ubiquitous surveillance possible at every point in the system. And this isn't technologically alarmist because the people who are implementing the system in London said this is not that far away and we can do it soon. Nevertheless, there's no reason to imagine that the worst has to come true, thanks to what you guys did at the Constitution Project. Politics makes a difference. Succumbing to the fallacy of technological determinism, because it can be done, it will be done, has always been wrong politically. The greater challenge and the more alarming thing to me, more alarming than the possibility of subway brain scans, is the fact, as Ginny, as you suggested, Ginny, that the cops like this stuff and people like this stuff. The most salient poll for me in the debate, or the most salient datum, was a poll right after the Patriot Act suggesting that 50% of the country thought it struck the right balance between privacy and security, 20% thought it didn't go far enough, and only 20% thought it went too far. 10% were undecided. That is our constituency. It's a bipartisan group. It's civil libertarian liberals and libertarian conservatives, but it will never be much more than 20% of the country, and in times of fear, when people freak out, lots of bad things will happen. So that involves fighting a lot of battles area by area, realizing that politics can constrain technology, but the battles do have to be fought.
Well, because Jeff, just to remind us, though, the polls were that way on the Patriot Act, but when total information awareness was put out there, the entire population objected, and Congress pretended to stop it. So it is, you know.
This is an important question, and it's the one we're talking about. I think it objected because everyone could envision that they were at risk. Jim said, the terrorists want to kill my family. The right response for the privacy side is the government wants to get your data and throw you in jail. It's a harder case to make because it's harder to come up with concrete victims or stories or ways of dramatizing the personal risk that these technologies pose to individuals, because the risks tend to be remote and on the horizon and futuristic, whereas the fears of terror are immediate and more concrete and real. But I think, from my two cents of what it's worth, which isn't much, is that I wouldn't minimize the threat at all. There's no need to get into that debate because empirically no one really has any clear idea about how direct the threat is. But it's to, and it's also, as Jim says, don't panic. RSI should say, panic. There's reason to be afraid if we allow these technologies to be constructed that could harm you and your family and American values in very concrete and tangible ways.
We're going to give Jeff the last word. Shout panic in a crowded.
Only at the RSI.
Well, I want to thank the panel. I think this has been a very interesting, very good panel. I think we've had both a view of what the future would look like, a view of the recent past that brought us here. I don't think we solved the problems, but then we didn't promise you or suggest that we would. So let's give a hand to the panel, and then and there will be a reception right next door. Thank you all very much. Thank you.